Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, a strong, sharp shot in the swirl of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we lurk out top-rate 8-bit comedy with award-winning comedian Laura Monmouth, explore the realms of post-punk avant-garde politeness with local legends The Courtesy Group, and take a thoughtful and reflective look at dementia through cutting-edge mask performance with Vamos Theatre. If you'd like to catch up on previous shows, find more information on featured artists, or suggest future features, you can find all our links at www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy. Now, West Brom comedian and winner of this year's Birmingham Comedy Festival Breaking Talent Award, Laura Monmouth, came in for questioning to help us get a grip on her vibrant culture clash approach to gender politics and modern living. Okay, so I'm joined by Laura Monmouth, and Laura, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the show, and rather excitingly, you are the winner of the Edinburgh Gin Birmingham Comedy Festival Breaking Talent Award 2018.
And it flows so well, doesn't it?
It does, it is, but that's great, that's a great achievement.
It's wonderful, it's something that I've been hoping that I would A, get an invite to, and then maybe just do well enough to actually win in what was actually a really strong field this year, so...
So that was quite a tense evening, I'm guessing, the final.
It helps when you know pretty much all of the other acts on, because obviously it's comedy and there's a lot of joking around backstage, which allows you to be taking the mick out of each other, and it does relax you. But by the time we got to the end, not so much nerves, but just trepidation.
There's kind of sibling rivalry, I guess.
It's sibling rivalry because you know that eventually you're going to have to go back to the green room and, yeah, everybody's going to be really, really nice to you and they're all seething inside. They wanted it as well.
And the final itself, I think you had 10 minutes or up to 10 minutes to kind of make people kind of fall out of their chairs.
It was 10 minutes.
And that's difficult, I think, for you in some ways because you're used to a longer set, aren't you? A longer play.
I don't do 10-minute sets very often. 10-minute sets I was doing maybe 2 or 3 years ago, but for the last probably 18 months I've been doing this this show. It's an hour long, and to take 10 minutes out of that show as a chunk, or maybe little bits of it, wasn't really going to work, so I just had to try and pressure myself to find 10 minutes of it that could potentially work, because everything I do is on a screen. I use a projector, I use a screen. So to take that amount of comedy out of the show and make it work in any kind of formula, I found really, really difficult. But I think it worked.
So it was kind
in
of
the end,
compressing and detaching something that is perhaps...
Well, it is, because it's quite tried and tested. I want to say it's very tried and tested. I'm not going to get ahead of myself, but it works in its own chunks, and there's a formula to putting together a show. But when maybe there's like one 10-minute chunk of the show which would work as a 10-minute bit, maybe, and that's the angle I had to take. And even then, I used 8 minutes and then just... I think blagged the last two.
You leave space for laughter, I think, and that's the key, isn't it? Now, let's talk a little bit about LGBTQZX.
Yes.
Now, some of our listeners will think, what on earth is that? Is that your licence number on your car? Is that your registration?
Or a really terrible hand in Scrabble, I don't know.
It would be a terrible hand in Scrabble. Now, but what it is, I think, and you can help me elaborate on this,
that's
is a kind of mix between, I guess, a gender-based comedy, but also... exploring that wonderful world of 8-bit technology.
Yeah, basically.
So the QZX bit is the Sinclair element, isn't it?
Well, it's the ZX, it's the Sinclair element. I was chatting on Messenger when I first came up with the concept of the show, which is not what the show ended up being, but that's by the by. But I was chatting to somebody on Messenger. Sometimes you're just flying ideas off at each other, and somehow we just came up with this. Wouldn't it be a brilliant idea for a name just to have both that? Because it's just nonsense, but it stands out. And 18 months later, I'm just thinking, I wish I'd called it something else. Because the amount of people that have tried pronouncing it as a word to me... No, it's not... No, it doesn't. It's a nonsense title, but it does get across the what the show's actually about, I suppose. And it is, more specifically, not the LGB bit, I suppose, it's the T bit and the ZX bit. It is about retro gaming, but that was the premise of the show. And 18 months later, it's evolved to something which probably is about 10% of both. So and a lot of nonsense.
I'm old enough to think the Q is not for questioning, but for QL, which was a kind of precursor to the ZX
spectrum. Oh, wow.
Anyway, we won't go too far into that. But you mentioned a phrase there, retro gaming, which is some folks won't know what that means, but it's really fashionable and kind of popular at the moment. In fact, we're sitting in the Mac, and Mac recently had a kind of retro gaming festival, a kind of Little Geeks festival. And it's really, I suppose, a celebration of old school technology.
It is, and there's a lot of discussion about what actually counts as retro gaming, because some people will take stuff and games from 10 years ago as being retro, but I'm 37 years old, and in my eyes, retro gaming is anything that I grew up with in the late 80s and early 90s. That's retro gaming to me, and people will see it differently depending on how old they are or what they perceive, but that's fine. With me, it's the stuff that I grew up with. The whole point of the show, and this is still part of the show, is that I never got to own a Spectrum because I was too young. They were out a few years before. That's why the ZX element came into it, because I still think, I mean, I still play them now, occasionally when I can. I don't have a lot of time for modern games at all. I don't play very much, honestly.
But I think that's an amazingly kind of creative angle to take, because I think it's quite brave in terms of using something very familiar and commonplace to explore some quite complicated issues and some quite, I think, controversial issues for some people. So
I think you're trying to say the word niche, that you can call it niche. It's niche, I understand. It really is niche.
I guess what I say, I think there's a great deal of creativity in terms of, you know, exploring gender issues and gender equality through Manic Miner, for example.
Yeah, as I said, I use a screen and I do some animations. I've spent a lot of time just sitting there just piecing together animations, and Manic Miner was one of the ones that I did, just giving a 30-second moment of a section of my life when I was 7 or 8 or 6 or something, and I put it to Manic Miner, and it was too niche. I had to drop it after the first 2 months. It was never going to work. And this is the issue that I've had with a lot of these, is they are too niche. You can create something which 1 or 2% of the population are going to get, or they're going to see as relevant to their life, and they might enjoy it. But you've got to try and keep everybody else on side as well, which is why I really scaled back talking about both, but trying at the same time to at least acknowledge their existence, because obviously the gender part of it is really important to me, and the games is something that, you know, has been a part of my life for over 30 years. So I need to incorporate them both, but at the same time, I need to put stupid nonsense bits in the show, which people, for some reason, seem to love. That's fine.
So for folks listening who don't know who Manic Miner, or what Manic Miner is, it's essentially a very early basic version of Super Mario, isn't it, really? I guess that's...
Oh, that's pushing it.
One way of putting it, I guess. There's this concept, there's an idea in what you do, which I find interesting, which I want to get your take on, which is this idea of sort of improved reality. And I think, crucially, what you do and do through comedy is you can relate big, serious things to, I suppose, more readily accessible ideas and icons, really.
The whole concept of improving reality, because I think a lot of people have gone into the concept of expectation versus reality, but I think it needs to be taken a step further, because you can just look at two funny pictures, oh yeah, that's what you expect, and that's the reality of it. You need to actually explore what makes it things better. And going back to the whole idea of gender, that's the whole point, is I've tried to improve reality with myself, so let's just base effectively the whole of the show around that, and then that does keep it accessible, because I'm hoping that at least a couple of people may have gone away from the show looking at their own lives thinking,
So how difficult has that been for you? Because I imagine you've put a lot personally into the show and into your comedy, and certainly what I've seen of your act, if you like, if I can call it an act, is, you know, there's some very personal elements to it. You know, it's some very real bits to it. How difficult has that been perhaps for you?
It's been quite difficult. There's so much that I've had to cut out though, because I'm not ready to talk about it yet. Which I think is the same for any comedian, will do the same, because if things are still really fresh in your mind, then you're gonna struggle to get it out and make it funny and actually get an audience on side to believe that you're enjoying talking about it, because people, for the most part, don't want to see somebody on stage having a breakdown because it's the first time that they've spoken about something in public. So there are so many elements of my past, at least, that I'm not ready to talk about. I've got a second show coming up. That's when it's going to happen. But for the moment, I think I've really just scratched the surface of actually what I want to say.
So do you think as you gain more perhaps confidence or experience as a performer, as a comedian, does it become easier perhaps to explore some of those things?
Well, I don't know, actually. When I started almost 6 years ago, back then it was a lot easier, I think, just to talk about things, because back then there were fewer raw memories, I suppose. And when you're fresh off the block and you've just started doing comedy, people are a lot nicer to you because you're doing smaller gigs, you're doing effectively open mic gigs, and when that happens, you've got an audience in there who are probably used to seeing newbies all the time, and they're a lot more forgiving, and that builds your confidence up to talk about things. And then a couple of years down the line, when you go back there and they maybe don't want to hear the stuff you were talking about 2 years ago, but you try and think of something new, something which they wouldn't have heard of, and you have to be honest, but they don't like it. If they don't go along with it, that's something that knocks your confidence, because this is what happened to me about 3 years ago, because I was almost on the verge of just stopping because I didn't know what direction I was taking. Perhaps it wasn't for me after all. This is probably just before I got the projector, actually, which has kind of saved me comedy-wise in more than one way and more than one occasion. But in terms of where I actually was 5 years ago, I am far more confident as a performer. I am probably not as confident talking about personal things.
So jumping forward to now and the kind of day-to-day, how do you approach writing? Are there funny things that strike you on a daily basis, or do you sit down focused and, you know, is that your Sunday gone? How does it work?
I spend a lot of time online. A lot of time online. I might see something and it might just give me an element of something that could work in a show. I don't try and write just like 10-minute pieces anymore. It kind of worked for the first show. There were bits and pieces, but then things happened in my life which just worked in weird ways just to push together to get an hour together. And I can't really sit down and just write anymore. I used to be able to, but that's when I was forcing to. I was forcing myself to do that almost every single week. I was making sure I went back to that same open mic gig, which I spoke about earlier, the same Thursday night every single week with a fresh 10 minutes just to get myself writing. And I can't do that anymore because I'm more focused on, I think, show writing without sounding, you know, pretentious. I think I'm quite good at that because I like the structure.
Finally, let's talk about What Next and that show and some of the things that you're developing. And again, it's really exciting, I think, for you. It's a good time for you, I think, at the moment, in terms of winning the Breaking Talent Award.
Absolutely.
And you know, lorry loads of gin as well, as we were discussing earlier on, all those kind of great things. So how are you refining and developing that show, and what kind of things are you plotting in terms of gigs and touring?
Well, I actually put a poll on Facebook for anybody that had actually seen the show a couple of days ago, because I went to go and do it in Nottingham. I did the Nottingham Comedy Festival on Tuesday evening. And I did it last year, a different venue, and I had two people, one who was the organiser of the room for the festival, and the other was a reviewer who was a friend. Got a decent review, he was quite honest, that's fine. But this year, he turned up, Diginette turned up, who was the organiser, and I got six more people there, and I put a poll up thinking, I've just performed to eight people in this room. I think it's the title of the show, shall I just bin it? Or shall I, and the poster, because the poster's very niche as well, it doesn't really give any idea, and just concentrate on the second show. And I don't know, but everybody says, just carry on with it. Don't be disheartened, because people in Nottingham weren't going to come out for it. I will carry on. I've got to carry on, because it's booked in for two big gigs next year. So I don't really have much of a choice, but It's going to carry on. LGBTQZX will carry on. It's not the same show it was this time last year, let alone when it started. I've got a week in Leicester Comedy Festival, like the biggest comedy festival in the country, where I'm doing that show, the new show, which is called Transvision Scamp. And that's all come off the back of the last couple of months. And obviously the Breaking Talent Awards help with that, because it just gets your name in there and they'll just try and get you in any way they can. So I've got like an entire week, the first week of Leicester. My name and face is all over the brochure. It's really weird. Not used to that. Don't like it.
I think the possibilities are endless. And for now, Laura, it's been great to chat with you. And I wish you every success.
Thank you so much.
And again, congratulations on your award.
There are lots of comedians around Birmingham. There are lots of comedians around the country. But to actually, in Birmingham, it's a big, big city. And there are a lot of comedians. To even end up in those five this year was great. To win was massive. So, thanks, guys.
Now, as the festive period approaches, prepare for a feast of events to keep you from the sherry. Sleeping Beauty continues its enchanting panto run at Coventry's Belgrade Theatre until Saturday, the 5th of January. Check out ticket prices and performance times at www.belgrade.co.uk. Or, if you fancy going a little bit wild, Tall Stories present Wild Creatures, based on the fairy tales of Oscar Wilde, at Warwick Arts Centre until Sunday, the 30th of December. Check warwickartscentre.co.uk for details. And now for something completely different. To coin a phrase. Hot on the release of new album Second City Liquor, I caught up with courtesy groups Al Hutchins and Dave Baker to explore their earthy, contagious sound. Let's start talking about the band, because Al, I'm looking at you to start with.
Right, okay.
Because the band's gone through, I guess, a sort of evolution, hasn't it? Kind of like most bands
that
do.
That would be an accurate term, yes.
So how would you describe it to folks?
Millions of years. Basically, I got to the point at the back end of the 90s where I had all this unreasonable amount of Aldi carrier bags full of scribblings of, you know,
music.
Yeah, poems or scraps of poems, stories. I wouldn't even say they were stories. They were kind of just stuff, really. The stuff and gear, I'll get back to that later on, as in differentiating between what is stuff and what is gear. But
that'd be important for our listeners.
Yeah, I think so. Maybe we could rig a quiz around it or something.
Yeah. Competition, yeah.
But I just wanted to do something with this because you know, it was there and it felt kind of wrong not to. So I started recruiting people. At the time I was working in a CD shop in King's Heath called the Polar Bear. A lot of people used to come in there and I'd put stuff on and try and get people to listen to this and listen to that. And the first lineup of the group I knew was nowhere near where I wanted it to be. However, I felt a kind of almost a violent impetus to just get something out there.
So what was the ethos for the band? What were you trying to create? You maybe didn't have the right characters, if you like, but what were you trying to get to?
I suppose I was looking at people that I liked who, because I thought, I knew I could write and I knew I could front a group. I spent most of the time listening to soul groups just prior to moving back to the city, my city, and I kind of saw it as a soul group, but I thought, can I sing? I thought, I don't know, really. But then I thought, hold on, all these people I like, John Lydon, Mark E. Smith, Patti Smith, Ian Curtis, Bob Dylan, just do it. The modus operandi was very much that, really, that it didn't matter. Because at the time there seemed to be a lot of bands that were kind of in the studio rehearsing five nights a week, week in, week out, and then actually doing a gig was... So when it got to a point where I kind of had the semblance of a lineup, I just grabbed the first gig I could, and it was just... It was rolling from there. So I suppose the ethos was to fuse what I was doing lyrically with something sonically that could meet that. And, to head off on that journey, and for it to not be like any other group, for it to be something that could perhaps match something more filmic. Obviously the literary thing's going to be there because of the lyrics, but in terms of adding the music, giving it another dimension, what I didn't want is some sort of singer-songwriter approach.
On Second City Liquor, which came out in August, I think, of this year, you're credited, you're described as doing the howling, the spiel, and the...
Poems.
Ah,
yeah.
I see.
That's I like to call them that because two reasons. There's a book by Ezra Pound called An ABC of Reading, or the ABC of Reading, that I read years ago, and that's what he calls them. So that kind of stuck with me. But I also hate, there's a certain vanity to people calling themselves poet. Like, everyone's a poet these days, aren't they? It's a very sort of self-proclaimed thing, whereas I'm quite old-fashioned in the sense that I kind of think that's for someone else to judge, really. So just calling yourself a poet doesn't really mean anything.
Dave, let's bring you in, because you're a drummer. So how did you come into the tent, as it were, in terms of the things that Al's describing, in terms of building a kind of a cast of rogues, I guess?
I filled in for a gig for our friend's birthday party.
It was so good that he turned up after... He had to hang around in Birmingham for a few hours, like waiting for us, because we had this... rehearsal booked at this lock-up, and he said, I said, oh, what did you do while you were waiting? And he said, oh, yeah, just had a drink. And I said, oh, you just a quick one. He said, no, I had about 8 pints. And I was like, because he was playing, he hadn't missed anything, you wouldn't have been able to tell.
So there's two albums, just for listeners, there's two albums, isn't there? There's the first record, which is Tradesman's Entrance, which came out in 2009, and then the recent release, Second City Liquor, that came out in August.
Yeah.
And I find it fascinating to listen to. Okay, the first listen, I found it a bit ragged. I'll be honest. That was my description.
Okay,
but there were some things that I could recognise that perhaps I'd heard in other places. That doesn't mean you sounded like other bands.
Do you think it's important to have to recognise things to connect to something you already?
For me, I think subconsciously I kind of probably associate bands with other with like terms, if you like, if that makes sense. So. For me, I think that the pointers, the markers, the Fall you mentioned, I could hear perhaps a similar influence. Mm. But one of the bands perhaps that struck me most, as a band I haven't listened to for a long time, in fact, is The Birthday Party. So kind of Nick Cave's kind of early outing. And there were some perhaps similarities there. But I generally found, certainly with the new record, that the more I listened, the more I wanted to listen. In the sense that initially I found it, some of the tracks were a bit kind of affronting, if you like. It's kind of like, oh, that's not the usual smooth jazz I'm used to.
It's funny because we put the, you know, when you put the video of Brickhouse Blues up online the other week, there was a thread of comments. The band are great, but I can't stand the singing or whatever it is. And I think a lot of people sort of get, there's an initial reaction that hopefully they come back to it later, but maybe they don't. That don't get past. Do you know what I mean?
I do. Yeah, yeah.
But I think for us, it's quite a subtle thing because we're not in the recording studio all the time, as you can tell. And when we are in there, we're all total devils for detail, aren't we? I mean, all of us.
Yeah,
really.
True. Yeah. Yeah.
So
I found with the singing or howling or however you want to describe it. There was a word that stuck in my head, and I thought, is this the appropriate word to describe it? And it is primordial, okay?
Right.
And that's quite a sort of highbrow word. But what really I was describing, I think, or trying to kind of get to, is there's an essential aspect to it. It's very straight and very kind of, you know, not unrefined, but very unfiltered or unaltered.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real quality.
Mm. That's a good thing. I have this thing where I think that sometimes, because everything is kind of gets watered down. So if you're in IKEA, I haven't been to IKEA for a few years, but whenever I'm in there, it's like Oh, you're going to hear Radiohead. You're going to hear... What couldn't you hear in IKEA? Because in a way, there's something to be said for that. Both stuff that is lyrically going to be offensive or sonically offensive. So what couldn't you hear in IKEA?
So one thing I find really interesting about the guitar on the new record is the guitar is almost a vocal. It's almost like a voice. So Al, you know, in some of the tracks, I think, to me,
being as objective as I can, I think the guitar is, no disrespect to you or to anyone else, but I think the guitar is the calling card for the album. I really do, and I think Hiday, I can say it because he's not here, but he is a bit of an evil genius, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
That's where he is, as he's plotting to take over the world.
Yeah, that's why he's not here.
Yeah. Why not?
Busy.
Let's talk specifically about a couple of tracks that are on the album. So that stood out to me, really, I guess. One is In the Rock, On the Rock.
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about that, because that's an interesting...
Okay, well, In the Rock, On the Rock predates the current lineup. So the previous lineup, which was me, DC, Fife and Bird, that was written so long ago that we're playing it with that lineup. Obviously, with Hiday on board, it's changed. In the Rock, On the Rock started from a kind of flippant remark that DC made about this pub in Alum Rock called The Rock, which doesn't exist anymore, and about smoking rocks in the bogs of The Rock. But yeah, so that's kind of become part of the gig spiel. I hate talking about the lyrics, but it's about characters. Like some kind of like an every man, every woman type of character that's the forgotten, but thinking more from like a kid's perspective, the kids that just get left behind.
let's talk about some of the what's coming next, because obviously you've just released an album or in the summer effectively, and there's quite a big gap between the albums and that. I think that's
trying to beat Pram's record.
But only just. So what's next? Have you got new things that you're building for a third album? Are you touring the second album, exploring that a bit more?
At the moment, we're just promoting this, and so we've got a gig on the 24th of November, which I'm hoping you guys hearing this afterwards are going to have the capacity to travel back towards with the Blue
Orchids.
There'll
be a blue telephone box somewhere that you could jump into.
Yeah, it's such a linear time, it's such a pain, isn't it? and there's other gigs coming up. So that's kind of preoccupied us, really. But really, I think we're all just itching to get to the next thing.
And spend a bit more time back in the studio and write some new stuff. That's starting afresh every time you've finished an album. It's like blank canvas, isn't it? You can do whatever you like.
I think with this, it's kind of so important, because the lineup that Dave's been part of for the last 10 years, we were at gigs, we were flogging the previous album, which only had me and DC on it. So I think having done that, it'd be good to just move on to something fresh. And the good thing is that when people are seeing us, we've played for so long that we can take lots of risk. I think a lot of it for us at the moment is logistics. It's just getting people into the room at the same time.
Because
when we are all there, things happen very fast, because there are a lot of different creative energies, a lot of ideas, and I think we know each other well enough. We've worked with each other well enough that there are no egos, really. So the way I've always seen this is it's the survival of the fittest idea. So if someone's got something and then someone else goes, well, I'm thinking, and you just thrash it out, because it's not about individuals. It's just, if something's good enough, if something's strong enough, someone is going to argue something out to the point at which it becomes clear that, yeah, actually, there's something here that we need to explore. And the same applies to gigs as well, because I think we've had quite a few tunes that, maybe didn't make it onto this album, that probably seem like they would, but they've just kind of fallen out of the live set. So sometimes you get something together and you play it a few times and then it just kind of falls away. Maybe it just doesn't have that. So the thing with performance, I suppose, is it gives us a chance to almost road test things that are going to be the basis for an album.
So folks that don't know the Courtesy Group, they should look on SoundCloud and Facebook and YouTube
SoundCloud,
and various places.
Facebook, Instagrams.
And the final question I want to ask, Al, it's a question for you, which is about your fantastic shirts that you wear at gigs. In fact, I think one makes it onto the CD itself.
Well, there's only one shirt. It's somehow good to, I'll call it the hardest working shirt in show business. But yeah, it's this sunflower shirt that I bought in 1996, maybe 1995, at Foster's, believe it or not, in Birmingham. And it's such an unlikely thing to find in what was then a very mainstream shop. I can only think that there was a buyer in there that was kind of probably now heading, it's probably like one of the leading, who just kind of thought, this is good. I'll get a few of them in. But I've never, that thing where you're wearing something, you pass someone in the streets is wearing it. I've never passed anyone. I think it'd be a kind of fallen moment. If I pass someone and say, well, I think I'm going to start wearing it. I once saw a chap wearing the same shirt, but the background was red instead of blue, selling the Evening Mail, who looked like he was just completely off his head. He looked like a pink cubby and all that. He's wearing that, and he's wearing that kind of, like a jacket over the top, like a suit jacket, and he was just unshaven and kind of a bit the worse for wear, but yeah.
Well, Al, Dave, it's been great to catch up with you.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Cheers, James.
Cheers. of gigs, news and releases, go to thecourtesygroup.bandcamp.com or find them on Facebook. You're listening to the New Curiosities Box, and I'm James Sandy. Earlier this month, I spoke to artistic director and founder of Vamos Theatre, Rachel Savage, about the final tour of Finding Joy, a masked-based theatre piece exploring the many aspects of dementia through humour and the very human. I also caught up with some of the performers behind the masks. So I'm with Rachel Savage, who's the artistic director and founder, I think, of Vamos Theatre. So, Rachel, welcome.
Thank you very much.
And it's great to catch up with you because you do some really interesting theatre and really interesting theatre projects. And we're here tonight in Bromsgrove, and you've done lots of dates and you've got lots planned. But let's start by talking about Vamos and the company really and the production. So,
sure.
If folks are new to that, what is that?
Firstly, Vamos tells stories that need to be told. There are always stories that I care deeply about. So say, for example, the show that you're going to see tonight is about dementia. The next show in the spring is about post-traumatic stress in the military. The one before was about forced adoption in the 1960s. My next show is called Dead Good. And you can only imagine what that's about. So I always focus on projects that I really care about and I think need to be told. And they're often stories about people who don't have a voice, and they're all given a voice through our full mask genre, which doesn't have words. So full mask means that an actor wears a piece of plastic over their face. They can't speak, they don't speak, and the audience in the first couple of minutes comes in and sits and thinks, why have I come see this? I'm not going to be able to understand a word of it. And within 2 minutes, they're laughing. Within another 10 minutes, they're belly laughing. And then by the end, they've gone through every emotion possible. It's a roller coaster ride. And when we say on a publicity, you'll laugh, you'll cry, we mean it.
So there's a couple of things there I want to just sort of explore. Mm-hmm. And the first is, I guess, the medium in terms of mask and mask theatre. Because there are a number of, I think, European groups that use that style. And usually, not exclusively, but usually to tackle some quite sort of controversial or sensitive topics. So how did you come to mask and using masks in theatre?
I started working with a theatre company called Trestle Theatre Company, and then there have been more full mask theatre companies since. Their work often is more farcical, I think, because I came to it from a background of I wanted to go into politics, and my mum said, no, don't go into politics, go into theatre. Kind of the wrong way around, really, isn't it? And so that's why I always tackle more sensitive subjects.
And the other question I wanted to explore from what you said initially was, how do you come to those stories? Are they through personal experience, or are they through your sort of the circles you operate in?
They always have to have an emotional attachment to me, because otherwise you don't care, and you've got to have that kind of personal belonging with the subject matter. Often I read stuff. So say, for example, with the Finding Joy that you're seeing tonight, that was about 9 years ago, and we were performing at the Hereford Courtyard, and the chief exec came to us at the end and said, I love your work, I'd like to make a co-production with you, and which was a huge honour and really exciting. And then he said the theme is dementia. So I started researching, and after 6 months of research, I thought I'd made a mistake, because all of the stories and novels and films and documentaries and films and endless interviews were negative. Everybody's story ended in death, and they were all miserable. And now I'm not saying that dementia is a joyful subject. I know from personal experience that it's not. But what I wanted to do was to find, as I said at the beginning, a story that needs telling, and also to find a way of how do we focus on the finding of the person and the constant looking for any which way to connect with that person, as opposed to focusing on the losing of that person. And it wasn't until I got in touch with an old family friend and found a true story that I found the true story that needed telling. So that's often how I find my pieces of my inspiration. You know, I sometimes come up with the subject matter first, I sometimes decide it, but then go on the track of the research and finding the story. And trying to find hope. What I don't want to do is find complete and utter despair in every subject matter that I choose, even though some are really tough. But it's looking for the hope and the different story. So also within that, I also start to change opinion, because people, so many people have been to see Finding Joy and then they've written and said, and now the entire family have been to see Finding Joy and now we look after our mum differently. And that's what I'm interested in.
And there's an element, I think, of the masks, which lends itself in some way to, I suppose, comic or satire performance. And what I mean by that is, and there's always a dark truth or a sharp truth in satire, and I wonder how the masks or the almost cartoon-like appearance help make it more readily accessible with more difficult things.
I think there's a few things about that. You will see a scene tonight where the audience will laugh a lot, and the audience will laugh because they recognise this character, the consultant at the A&E. And it's all based on a true story where Joy had the terrible fall and had to go to A&E and was examined. And being in examined, so it was Audrey, the true story that it happened to, she has a handbag, and her handbag is her anchor. And so many women of her generation are very similar. And in the examination room, the consultant was constantly trying to take this handbag away from her because he was thinking that it was stopping him being able to do his job properly. And it's people laugh and laugh and laugh because, exactly as you say, because they recognise it, and they too have been outraged and hurt by that character.
So let's talk a bit more about Finding Joy, which is, I think, part of, I suppose, a series of exploring joy, if you like,
yes,
or different aspects of
yeah,
joy.
Yeah.
There's a play on
yeah.
words there. But essentially, we're talking about a communication, perhaps, across generations and a supportive relationship that develops in a very serious situation in terms of, you know, dementia and the onset of dementia. And that's quite a common story, isn't it? But perhaps not told too often.
It's a common story. It's a really common story. You know, a million people are going to be diagnosed and living with dementia by 2025. There's over 700,000 carers in the country at the moment looking after loved ones. I think the story that I found in some ways was usual because it's a love story between a grandchild and a grandmother. And, you know, we recognise those relationships as almost the more joyful and the more, you know, they don't come with the same baggage as looking after
them. It's a kind of short circuit, isn't there?
Absolutely.
Around the parents,
yep.
It's that kind of thing.
Yep. And it's based on a true story. So when I found this true story of this, well, it's a love story between Rowan and his mum and his grandmum, Audrey. And he saw that his mum was struggling looking after her. He also had left school and didn't know what he wanted to do, and he was into his mates and his gang and his football, but he could see that his mum was struggling, so woke up one morning and said, I want to become Grand's carer. And so they got him his training, which was 2 days of how to become a carer and a couple of hours in how to become a carer for somebody living with dementia. And thank goodness he was a natural, and he's a natural because of his playfulness, his acceptance, his fun. You know, this young man is, he's young, he's not a saint, slightly anarchic, but he's really good at reading somebody's mood and their body language. And so Audrey, his gran, often didn't know who she was. She didn't know who he was, but what she did know was when that young man walked in that room, her life lit up. And when I used to say to Rowan, how did you learn? And he'd say, my gran taught me everything.
So touring is a big thing that you've been doing,
yep.
and this is a massive programme of dates, isn't it? And I think you've got some big, I suppose, names on board in terms of other organisations to support you. Tell me a little bit about that, because I guess also every time you perform this, it changes slightly and it's different from venue to venue?
Yeah, absolutely. So on this tour, for example, we'll be touring to the Malvern Coach House, which is a 67-seater, and that's the tiny little theatre where we first built and made and performed the show. To 10 days earlier, we'll be touring to the RSC, and we'll be doing 3 gigs there. And that's been a project, a partnership with the RSC that has been going for the last year, where we have performed Sharing Joy, which is our show for people living with dementia. And we've been delivering our workshops, Listening With Your Eyes. And so Finding Joy going there will be a culmination of this whole project. And it's just exciting. And this week we also go to Spain. So we go to Spain this week, and then in a couple of weeks we're also touring to Germany. So in one week we might have a relaxed performance. In another show we might then be doing a rural touring gig in a village hall, and then we might be getting on an aeroplane and playing on a made stage in a Spanish festival.
So I'm with James Greaves.
Correct.
And Sarah Nelson.
Hello.
Two of the performers from Finding Joy. And we're fresh from the performance, so they're resting easy.
Still sweating.
Still sweating, nursing some muscles, maybe. And it was a great performance, so well done to both of you.
Thank you.
And I want to start with how easy or stroke difficult it is to approach something like this. Because folks listening, just to describe it very briefly, there's no dialogue, is there?
Everything's
very physical.
No.
And the use of masks means you've got really a kind of fixed face, a fixed facial expression.
Yeah. The audience interpret our body language, so they're filling in all the information that the characters on stage are feeling or the things that they're thinking. As for approach to it, you know, it's rather different to straight acting. We don't speak. We are completely concealed under the costume and the mask, so we don't get to use our lovely voices. So thanks for coming.
I really love the approach working in mask. I think it's, yes, it's very different to acting in terms of no text, but it's still the same principles. It's still the same body language. It's still the same physicality. It's just we really have to be very specific and clear. And I liken it as well to puppetry. And in terms of puppeteering, you have to be very specific about your action so that the image that you're painting, you're sharing, is very clear. And you know, it's an incredibly accessible form for any audience member all across the world, you know.
It's kind of like watching a silent movie.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch a Chaplin or Laurel and Hardy, the early silence, you know, they're telling the story, they just don't need the words, but they cheat, they use title plates every now and then. We don't, because we're much more clever than them.
Do you think that silence helps with, I was going to use the word pathos, you know, the kind of severity almost of the subject. Do you think it helps sort of amplify some of the sort of emotion?
It generates more empathy, I think, for me, on a very broad brushstroke. I think that we, you know, that's how we kind of started in the world, you know, watching and, you know, reading the world, you know. And so I think it's something that really kicks into our very core of human empathy and instinct and opens you up.
Yeah, I think it does heighten the empathy feeling from the audience, because they're having to work sort of quite hard to interpret us. You know, not consciously, but they are constantly, as I said before, filling in the gaps, trying to work out what we're thinking, what we're feeling. And so that opens them up more. So it's a very sort of interactive kind of way of performance.
And practically, what's it like inside those... what's it like inside that head? I was going to say.
Heads.
I guess it's probably akin to sort of playing Darth Vader or something, isn't it? You've got very sort of...
A lot less money.
Yeah. Probably. Is it very restrictive? Is it something you get used to? Does it become intuitive? Or
all of the above.
Okay.
Yeah. It's warm. It's limited vision. They're plastic masks, so they're hard. You know, I've worked with latex masks, so it's very malleable on your own face, and you can really feel every kind of part of the mask. These are quite hard in terms of the plastic, but in terms of its limited vision, I find that really helps articulate the expression of the mask and the character as well, because we are physically looking to where we are, and it gets quite hot under there.
And very occasionally I do get a little bit of claustrophobia. You know, if you're sort of in a box wearing a mask and you can't see anything, you're in the pitch black, you want to take it off quite quick. But, you know, you just have to breathe into it.
Breath's
and crack
very
on.
Important
Breath
on
is
levels.
Very important, yeah.
And is it similar, Sarah, you've done, I think you mentioned sort of puppeteering and, mm-hmm. And work with puppets. Is it a similar ball game to that, or is it, again, quite different? Because I think as an audience member sitting there, there's a mannequin quality to it, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Is it similar to work within that way?
The principles, I think, of puppetry and mask work are very similar, and the relationship with the audience is very similar in that you're really asking the audience, as James was saying, to work harder, to fill in, and the gaps, not necessarily the gaps, but just to help interpret the story. But the principles of puppetry and mask, in that it is about very clear, defined action. It's about very distinct movement, and rhythm is very much a part of storytelling. The way that the rhythm changes, you know, really helps to portray an emotion, an expression. So yeah, I wouldn't say that we're mannequins as such, but in terms of our movement, it's very specific.
And because the audience are sort of reading the emotions onto the mask, onto us, you know, the mask, the illusion of the mask is that it appears to move. It's a solid object, but, you know, people say, I swear that mask smiled or really cried. But it's just the audience watching the whole physicality of the character on stage and interpreting.
Mm. Just finally, I'm just interested to get a take from both of you on what you hope people might take away from the production, from the performances.
Well, I hope they've had a good time. Primarily, you know, I want to entertain people as an actor, and so we hope they enjoy the production. It is a very emotional and emotive theme. Dementia. My father died with dementia 2 years ago. It's quite hard doing this show back then. And we do get a lot of people sort of who've gone through the gamut of emotions, you know, from because a lot of gags. It's not a heavy show. It's quite light. We keep it light. A lot of jokes, but there is, your word, pathos as well.
It's also, I find, because we speak to the audience after every show, and I find that it is such a, I just think theatre across the board should be doing this. It's actually a really integral part of the show for us, and to have that feedback. And just hearing what some people say who have either gone through it or have... I had one man with a beaming smile come up and give us a big hug and say, I've just been diagnosed with dementia, thank you for that beautiful show. But he had the biggest smile on his face. And there is literally in the title, finding joy in something that is very challenging, and it's different for every person. But for me, performing it and speaking with people afterwards, I actually hope that people come away with a sense of joy and hope that what's going on for someone with dementia isn't necessarily always bad. You know, that in that imagination and in the mind, there could be happy memories. And it's finding, as for carers and for family as well, it's finding a way to access and accept something that can be very challenging, and keeping it light as much as possible. And it is about finding hope, I hope, in the experience. It's not always easy, but you know, I met someone as well last night after the show who wept, and you could tell that she hadn't wept for a long time, and that she was struggling with the support in her family because they weren't coping. And so I hope that also that opened up a door for the family to start talking about how they were feeling, because it's very easy for us to shut off and not talk about the feelings and cope in different ways. So here's to opening up conversation and connecting.
Excellent. I really enjoyed the show, and it's been great to get a chance to talk to you both. For now, Sarah, James, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There'll be a special extended documentary version of this section of the show on Vamos and Finding Joy, set for broadcast here on Switch 107.5 on Wednesday, the 12th of December at 7 p.m. Check our website for more information. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Vamos Theatre, Artrix Bromsgrove, Laura Monmouth, Mac Birmingham, The Courtesy Group, RSC Stratford, M7PR, 448 Creative, and a special credit for the original music composed by Jani Armour for Vamos Theatre and featured with kind permission. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.